Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. It's Jamie Dodd and Thomas Drantz. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line, Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. This hour of Canucks Talk is brought to you by Rack Steel. Rack Steel has the expertise to get you operating faster with forklifts and pallet racking in stock. Visit them online at racksteel.com. Now joining us from NHL.com and In Goal Magazine, he is a presentation of White Rock Hyundai. He is the excellent Kevin Woodley. Woodley, thank you as always. How you doing?
I'm good. You guys, you've recovered from watching last night and all the stress that comes with it?
Yeah, my voice is, I'm actually a little surprised. It's a little raw, I'm going to admit. The great thing about it was, like, the game ended at, like, what, like 8:30, 8:45, something like that. So, you know, it's not, it was a late night. I grabbed some pizza on the way home from the watch party. I felt great waking up, but the voice is feeling it a little bit.
How much of your stress during that game was Jordan Binnington induced? Like
significant.
How much of the narrative was destroyed by the end? How much of the stress was caused by
a lot of it, man. A lot of it was Binnington induced, and a lot of it was Sanheim Parayko induced.
Yes. The Colton Parayko train for being a part of the next year. Like, there's a lot of lessons learned here too. Like,
Who's
not going to be on the team next year? And listen, injuries, obviously, Shea Theodore, Alex Pietrangelo, like
Morrissey,
you know, there's a lot of conversations that'll be had about that.
Yeah, so, I think we're talking about Parayko differently, in my opinion, if it's Morrissey Parayko. We're probably talking differently about Sanheim if it's Sanheim Pietrangelo. I just think Sanheim Parayko, the calibration, they didn't have enough speed to get out cleanly on retrievals the way that, you know, Brock Faber and Jake Sanderson were able to repeatedly do for the American side.
Yeah, and obviously that's in part a function of the speed with which the Americans were able to forecheck part of that equation. And, you know, to bring it back to the goaltending, which is what I'm supposed to do, how much worse would it have been if you didn't have a guy out there stopping damn near every rim and setting up pucks or making quick chips to lead the transition? I mean, I thought after Brady scored that first goal for the U.S., you sort of saw a little body language from Binnington. And I genuinely, without having seen if anyone asked him, I don't think it was frustration that the goal went in. I think it was frustration that, in retrospect, it's a rim he would have liked to have gone out and handled, even though it started up on the glass, and that's when you're supposed to leave it. It came down onto the boards, and I think Binnington, I mean, by the end of that Finland game, he was pulling pucks off the glass anyways. I think, you know, in his mind, probably would have liked to have gone out and handled that and prevented any forecheck that ultimately led to the goal.
I want to add one other guy who was filling me with anxiety throughout the game. Connor McDavid.
Big moment at the end.
Yeah.
He himself,
iconic,
like,
moment.
Full credit for him afterwards saying, like, not a great game up till that point.
I would say it was one of the worst performances I've ever seen from him. And granted, that's a hugely high bar, right? Because I'm used to him going, like, absolute freak mode, you know? And I just,
that was anything but for most of that game. And
he couldn't handle passes. I've never seen that. He's the most skilled guy in the world. Like, it was completely baffling. And then one moment of brilliance, one sliver of ice, gets completely loose and lost in the slot, and boom, Hellebuyck never stood a chance. Yep.
And the one thing I would say in terms of, like, not handling passes and everything else, like, not to sound like Rick Tocchet talking about Elias Pettersson, but he stopped moving his feet too, right? Like, we know how fast and how dynamic he is. There were a couple of rush chances the other way for the United States where when the puck was turned over, there was a moment of hesitation of just standing still rather than immediately starting to backtrack. And as fast as he is, he got back into one of them, but not fully. And that hesitation of, that sigh, that, you know, letting the air out before you start coming back hard and immediately, it was evident on TV, and it almost proved costly a couple of times. And I would suggest that I don't know if it's the stress of the moment or the fatigue that comes with this event, but it's not what we're used to seeing. And it was a little worrisome at times. It caused me stress. That's where my stress was. And interestingly enough, if we want to tie this back to the Canucks, I think that's the one thing, one of several things that have changed in their game over the last 2 weeks is the way forwards are coming back without that hesitation and with more pace and with more consistency and lower in the zone. And talking to a bunch of guys this week during practice, how much easier that makes it for them to get back to their transition game as a defensive group when the guys are back where they're supposed to be sooner. Off transition both ways.
On Binnington, Woodley, before we just move on from his story, I mean, I was watching the game at a table with Greg Ballack, who's like the Sportsnet 650 resident goalie guy, and for the first 60 minutes, Ballack was kind of losing his mind watching Jordan Binnington. What were you thinking? Like, what was your sense of where his game was? What was going through your head watching him, again, before overtime, where he was fantastic?
Well, there. I mean, the one moment that stuck out, and I'm sure you heard all about it, sitting there with Greg, was the second goal. I mean, he makes a really tough save. The chance right before the rebound that leads to the goal is a pretty good look from a pretty good spot, but he's at the left edge of his crease, and the puck goes to his right. And, you know, from pre-Pee-wee on, that is lift your left skate, rotate, and push across in a butterfly slide. And he literally got up off the wrong leg, which is the kind of stuff we used to see from NHL goalies in the 2000s. You know, I remember like Dan Kluche routinely got up off the wrong leg, and guys of that era sort of talking about learning this new way of doing things, and how 12-year-olds were, you know, better than them at that, because as soon as it moves to your right, I lift my left leg to push across in a butterfly. If it moves to my left, I lift my right. It's just the most efficient manner to get there. And so to see him in that moment get up with the wrong leg, something you're taught since you're like 10 or 11 years old, and to see it cost him on the goal, because the delay is he has to then hop step across rather than just sliding with coverage along the ice, and ultimately it's a quick chip along the ice that goes in. That one had me a little worried. It's even as sort of much as he plays a little outside the boxes, and I thought, you know, some of that was that's Binnington at his best, even if it does cause you stress. That one, there's a technical foundation moment that you're like, that just has to be an absolute. But there are, yeah, I thought he was more assertive. I thought he was more aggressive. And while that also left him with a lot of area to recover back to his post, and the Americans were clearly trying to bank pucks off of him as he did that several times. And as much as that can cause anxiety watching, yeah, I think that's a little more the swagger and style that Binnington at his best plays with. And so the fact he sort of had some of that heading into the overtime, you know, was probably should have been seen as a positive, even though, like you said, it's a little anxiety producing when he's, you know, having to recover so far because he is out at the top of his crease or beyond in a lot of those situations. You know, make a breakaway save off Larkin, but then almost get caught trying to get back to your post afterwards off the rebound. Like that's sort of your peak Jordan Binnington experience.
So, Kevin, we've gone 10 minutes with you and not talked about a Canucks goaltending contract, which just goes to show you how much Team Canada matters to all of us in this city. Canucks always lead on Canucks Talk, except today. But let's get into the Lankanen and stuff. I want to tell you what I'm hearing about this deal and just get your reaction to it, to what I'm about to say. So,
okay, you're more plugged in than me, so let's hear it.
So here's what I'm hearing. Negotiations basically got done yesterday, but were stimulated more by the club's desire to get this deal done before they came back from the break, as opposed to any update on Thatcher Demko's health. Club, while recognizing obviously that Demko's had a difficult season injury-wise, and that playing some role in wanting to purchase more insurance than Jim Rutherford typically has with his backup goaltenders, you know, fundamentally this team still believes in Demko if he can stay healthy and still want to, you know, be in that business. But Lankanen's character, the way that he's performed, the fact that he's carried the team, there was a desire to reward that and a desire to keep him in the fold, obviously, long term. What's your reaction to what business the Canucks have transacted today and what I just told you?
I mean, it all kind of checks out. I mean, like, I think as good as Lankinen's been between the crease, we've had a glimpse of the kind of person he is in the room and off the ice, right? Like, this is a guy that, you know, basically does daily affirmations of gratitude for his position in life and in the league. This is a guy who bet on himself when no one was willing to give him what he wanted in free agency. And I got to say, as much as the Canucks deserve to be lauded for getting him on the cheap going into the season, the move was to buy multiple years for a little more on July 1st. And I can say that in retrospect because I said it on July 1st, not for them necessarily, but for some team, right? Like, at the end of the day, he gets to September 21st and signs as training camp has already opened because nobody would meet to ask that was in the $2 million range. How much are you laughing right now if you met that for multiple years, even if you had to go, say, 2.5 to get a couple years out of it, right? Like, that's why you buy Charlie Lindgren at 1.3 for 3 years, because all the same markers that applied to him then applied to Lankinen this summer, rather than, yeah, okay, we got him cheap 1 year, but now we've got to pay heavy to lock him up. That said, I understand the investment, both because of what he can be and has been for most of this season as a goaltender and the previous two. Interestingly enough, to an even higher degree, like his numbers in the previous two seasons in a much smaller sample are actually outperform what he's done this year on a sort of per shot basis. But also, again, the person, like the sort of smile that he constantly brings to a locker room that doesn't always and hasn't always this year had enough of them. So, and the work ethic that comes with it and the relationship that he has with the goaltending coach who's in place now. So I understand all of those things from a Vancouver Canucks perspective, and mostly you're just happy for a guy who, like I said, bet on himself, but also does a lot of things the right way, that he gets rewarded.
So Lankinen will turn 30 in April, so he'll be 30 going into the first year of the deal next season. And, you know, 5 years, I think even more than the salary, that kind of popped out at me. But it's also interesting because he just hasn't played that much, right? He's had 146 games in the NHL, and even you go back to, you know, his couple years in the AHL, didn't play a ton. So does that lack of kind of wear on his tires, does that offset some of the aging concerns as he moves into his 30s for you?
Yeah, a little bit. And also the fact that I don't see, I'm trying to remember back to Chicago, like there's not a history of injury here.
Yeah.
You know, in terms of, like, you know, all those sort of low games played are because he was behind UC Saros, not because he couldn't stay healthy. You know, his game is built on quickness rather than power. You'll see sometimes where he makes a save at the top edge of the crease and has to get back to the post on the other side. And he does it not through one big loaded up powerful movement, but he'll actually grab an edge twice as he gets from top of the crease to the far post. And that's pretty rare these days. Like most guys, it's all about one big powerful push. And a lot of people look at him and, oh my God, he's got to push twice to get there. But it's his quickness and his speed that allow him to overcome having to push twice. But I think quickness versus power and loading up and big extended pushes probably bodes well for not putting your joints and your muscles, you know, sort of through starts and stops in full extension and at peak power. So that might be a part of why he's managed to stay healthy all this time. So yeah, I kind of agree with that. At the end of the day, hasn't played a lot. Like, I guess to go back to what Thomas was saying about, you know, his understanding of it, the only question is like where you see or where they see the games played upside here, at what level, because as good as he's been, as I mentioned, the adjusted numbers aren't quite as good as they were in Nashville, and where they've fallen off is when he gets overplayed or when he starts to play too much. And you can see the fatigue in his game, and you can see the bad goals that weren't there before that fatigue sets in. You can see those start to go in, and they've kind of submarined. There's just been a handful of games where you can see where he gets to that stage. There was one here against Edmonton. I think the other one might've been in Winnipeg, where it submarines his numbers, and you can see it clear as day. And so the beauty is, you're buying a guy who can give you a great start once a week or once every 2 weeks. Not that you'd pay somebody $4.5 million to do that, but he's done it in the past. And there are a lot of those guys out there. I mean, the Dallas Stars are getting great minutes out of Casey DeSmith right now, and he's locked up for 3 years at just $1 million. The difference is not everyone can give you two straight months of number one goaltending or more at a starter rate the way Lankinen has done. And so to me, that's where that threshold in terms of what you have to pay shifts. And the question there is sort of, when I say can give you two great months, you still have to balance that with enough rest in between, which is where having a third goalie is going to be oh so important, whether it's now in the short term or depending on how they move forward with Demko. It's really easy to say Demko and him are a great fit at 9.5 next year. It's if Demko has a good summer and comes back and has a full healthy season, he's an $8.25 million goaltender based on the new standard. Are you willing to invest at close to $13 million for both at that point?
Yeah, as I said earlier in the show, it feels like you pay Lankinen in this deal to make him one half of a goalie tandem, right? That caps out at, as you said, you know, 9.5, maybe $10 million, something like that, as the cap goes up. But the question is whether Thatcher Demko is going to be the other half of that goalie tandem, or is he going to be too expensive and you're going to have to look for other options? But, you know, I don't think you're expecting Kevin Lankinen to be like a 55 game plus for you type of goalie. But, you know, half of a goalie tandem that's a pretty close to a 50-50 split seems like the path forward here.
Yeah, and interestingly enough, like, the interesting thing here is I think a lot of us thought Charlie Lindgren was about to set this market. And the reporting had been between 3.5 and 4. I can tell you right now, one team that probably looked at this contract today and went, ugh, was the Washington Capitals. Because, you know, again, Lindgren is that comparable, actually has produced slightly, even in after a down start to this season, his adjusted numbers are slightly ahead of Lankinen. And he was the number one that got them into the playoffs in Washington last year. And now all of a sudden, his camp's got to be wondering if that negotiation needs to shift upwards a little bit. So it's interesting times. I know there are teams and some people that believe this market, again, not, I don't think it's right to say for backup goaltenders, for guys who are 1B that have that, you know, starter upside, like Lankinen has shown, like Lindgren has shown, is going to increase significantly as the cap goes up. I'll believe it when I see it. We're already seeing number ones get paid more over this past year than they have in the past. But if that's the way things are going and the cap keeps going up, then this becomes a number you worry less and less about.
Between this range of goaltenders, let's call it Decord, Lukanen, Lankinen, and I guess we can throw Thompson in, although as the number and the term both indicate, he's kind of in a different tier, right? So let's remove him. The other three, Decord, Lankinen, and Lukanen. If you were signing one of these 1B goaltenders with, you know, between 120 and 150 games of experience to multi-year big money contracts, which would you most want to be in business with?
Ooh, that's a really good question, Thomas. I mean, honestly, it's funny. I go to the numbers quite often just because I want to refresh and know where I'm at and where these guys are sitting. You know, Lankinen and Joey Decord have an identical adjusted save percentage right now. Identical on the season. I think with Ukko-Pekka Luukkonen, who would have been above both of them last year, but is actually slightly underwater relative to expected this year in Buffalo, you know, you'd be buying upside and potential, whereas with both Decord and Lankinen, you've got it more proven, but in a late blooming commodity. And I think because of the sample size on those two, especially Decord, cause he's now had a year as a number one. And again, interestingly in Seattle, like his numbers were ahead of Lankinen up until recently. They're coming back down. And so as the sample size increases, like I have those two in a similar breath. And again, to me, the difference is when Seattle signed Decord, it was pretty clear that it was to be their number one, more 1A than 1B moving forward. Even though Grubauer's there and making more money, this was a passing of the torch. And I don't think anyone in Vancouver, for now at least, views that the same way with Lankinen and Demko.
Kevin.
Do we?
Sorry?
Do we? Maybe that's a wrong assumption.
No, I think that's I think it's a fair assumption. I don't know exactly sort of my spin on it yet, but I'll think about it. I want to just, before we let you go, ask you one more, which is Canucks have a 4-6, but it's a weird 4-6 where they play two sets of back-to-backs with 2 days in between. What do you expect from the Canucks on this upcoming 5-game road trip? We know that Thatcher Demko won't be going on it. How many games can Demko realistically, or sorry, can Lankinen realistically start during this trip? And how high are the stakes for Artur Shelovs?
I think smartly, Lankinen starts 3 games. And your answer beyond that will depend on how he's feeling coming off of the Four Nations. Obviously, Finland hasn't played since Monday, so there's a little bit more of a break. But I've talked to a few people that were around it that said not to underestimate the mental fatigue that comes with having been a part of that. So does he start tomorrow in Vegas, or is it in the second end in Utah? Yes, there's no travel or very minimal travel in LA with the Kings and the Ducks, everything in Orange County. So could you play him in 3 of those 4? I guess so. And then have a little break before you go into Seattle and play him 4 or 5? I guess so. But for all the reasons I just gave you in terms of where his play has been at its best and when it has started to dip, and given how the schedule rolls out moving forward into March, I think, you know, my hunch would be Artur Shelovs plays 2 of these games. Now, that probably goes out the window because of the stakes of the season. You talk about the stakes for Artur Shelovs. Probably goes out the window if the first one stinks, right? Like, because I think we got to the point where the consensus by the end with Demko coming back, and this is where they overplayed Lankinen for one of the stretches, was that they just didn't trust Artur's going in there, right? Like, they'd lost whatever faith he had earned in the playoffs last year. And so that first one's going to be important for him. You know, I think for them as an organization, I'd still want to give him the second one, even if, unless like it just falls off a cliff in the first one, I'd still go back in the second, because you do need to potentially reestablish him. I believe he's on a 1 year next year as well. There's that. So it's incredibly important. Now, the good news is, and I sort of hinted at this earlier, like looking at some of the underlying numbers and having conversations around the room, the task is going to be a lot less difficult, or should be, if they can pick up where they left off for both goalies compared to what Artur's was facing at the start of the season, where things were inevitably a lot looser, a lot less controlled in terms of the defensive environment than they have been over these last 8 to 10 games.
Woodley, you're the best, man. Thanks for doing this. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, guys.
That is Kevin Woodley on Sportsnet 650, brought to you by White Rock Hyundai. Visit the showroom on King George and White Rock, or whiterockhyundai.com. And lots more to get into on the Canucks as we transition out of Four Nations mode back into your typical Canucks talk programming. Although we will talk a little Four Nations with Dim in the final segment. But you, I know you've got a lot of Canucks stuff to get into. We'll let you empty the notebook. We'll get into all of it on the other side here on Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk, Sportsnet 650. Jamie Dodd, Thomas Drance here. We're live from the Kintec studio. Kintec Footwear and Orthotics, working together with you in step. 650-650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Can't find the latest episodes of your favorite HGTV, Discovery, and Food Network shows? Rogers Xfinity TV has the newest seasons of the top-rated shows on these popular channels, while other providers are no longer including them in their TV lineup. If your TV provider doesn't carry these channels, you're missing out on new seasons of Celebrity IOU, Hometown, Beat Bobby Flay, Expedition X, and more. Don't be fooled by other channels pretending to be these networks you know and love. Get the latest with Rogers Xfinity TV at rogers.com. All right. It is Canucks Talk, of course, on Sportsnet 650. And We're coming out of the break. The Canucks are back on the ice tomorrow. Seven games between now and the trade deadline all of a sudden for the Canucks. And as we were having that conversation with Kevin Woodley, and one of the things you said to him was the Canucks were very motivated to get this deal done with Kevin Lankinen before they came back from the break. And of course, this is not the only recent contract extension they've given to a pending UFA. Marcus Pettersson, Drew O'Connor also earning deals. That sense of let's get some business done, very evident. Also very glaring, maybe in the absence of that list, is Brock Besser.
Yeah, and while we were spinning our wheels with other scheduling concerns, Cam Robinson reported much of what I was about to report on our airwaves. He was told, this is a tweet from Hockey Robinson, and I'll use this as a departure point before filling in the gaps. I'm told that both Brock Besser and the Canucks understand what each side wants, and it's not the same thing at this point. Teams continue to call on him while the club considers the value of using him as their own rental for a playoff run if common ground can't be found. That matches very closely with what I'm hearing. I can add some texture to it, though. Contract talks aren't ongoing because both sides have a sense,
right?
Both sides have a sense of what this market looks like from each other's perspective. And obviously there's disagreement there. And, you know, look, you players have to work a long time and play a lot of hockey before they become eligible for unrestricted free agency. This is only Besser's first UFA eligible season. You know, the market is going up, right? The cap is going up. Brock Besser is a goal scorer. He's a player who may have had durability concerns in the past and sometimes still unfairly gets tagged with, oh, but he's, you know, had these injury issues. Guy's missed an average. Do you know how many games on average per season Besser has missed across the last 5 years?
How many?
5.7.
Yeah.
Like, he's missed like 27 games across the last five seasons. So the fact is that Besser is a largely durable player who scores at a 30 goal per 82 game rate like clockwork. Nothing is more marketable on the open market than goal scoring ability. Besser can play top line minutes. He's not a defensive stopper, but he earns trust to play those minutes. That matters a lot to hockey teams. And good person, good teammate, came up clutch in the 2024 Stanley Cup playoffs. Like, that's a pretty good resume to get paid.
It's a great resume. It's a like just really, really solid.
It's a really
resume.
Strong. It's
even like first round pedigree. You know what I mean? Even, which matters a lot often for these guys.
100%. Even his age, right? Like, Besser's going to hit the market as what, a 27-year-old, 28-year-old?
28, I think. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. He's 27, but he turns 28 in 4 days. Okay, so he as a 28-year-old, I mean, that's a hugely marketable, hugely appealing asset, and the Canucks love the player at a certain price point. And yet this is a pretty unique opportunity for Besser and company. So there's space there without question. Can that space be bridged? Well, it doesn't seem like there's a ton of like urgency to bridge it at the moment. Frankly, they're just an understanding of what it could look like. And to this point, anyway, an unwillingness on the Canucks end to move to make that deal happen. Now, the key part of this is, the Canucks are looking at their team, right? They came into the break playing pretty good hockey, controlling play well, winning games. You know, they want to kind of buy time and see what they've got here. They're very likely to make the playoffs, as we discussed in our first segment. And this next seven games, I think, is going to be pretty important in terms of dictating where the organization's level of confidence is on whether or not they're going to make it and what that entails from a seller's perspective.
I really have a hard time wrapping my head around own rental Brock Besser.
Me too.
Like,
me too.
That's just, and especially if it's like, hey, we won six of those seven games. I guess we'll keep them. That's not good process.
It's not good process, but it does make some sense in the perspective from the perspective of, even if you deal Brock Besser, say you win six of seven,
mm-hmm.
but decide, hey, look, we just got to do it.
Yeah.
So you trade Brock. You're still going to use part of what you need
yes.
to buy a Brock Besser replacement, and that player is probably not going to be affordable. Jason Zucker is not going to be affordable to fill in a top-line winger. You know, like, this team's probably needs another top-nine forward as it is, to be totally honest with you, Jimmy.
Yep.
So, you know, there's probably a price point at which Besser as an own rental makes sense. Like, if you can only get a late first for him, like if you're talking Besser for a late first versus keeping him for a playoff run, You know, I can at least understand why that's a decision to be handled with some gravity.
Yeah.
By the way, this also applies. So the next seven games are going to matter a lot in terms of shaping the club's own rental decisions with Besser, Pugh Suter, and Derek Forbert, their remaining pending UFAs. I want to note, too, that Irfan Gafar has added that the club has had a number of chances to re-sign Besser and have used still evaluating as a reason to not do it. It's pretty simple. Brock likely wants term, 7-8 years, and the Canucks aren't willing to do that. He'll get it and get paid what he wants somewhere else if something doesn't change. So that's the state of things as it pertains to Brock.
And interesting that Irf is saying like term is really the sticking point from the Canucks perspective. He's suggesting there, right? Like that it's term is what he wants. That's what they are unwilling to give. They would probably be much more comfortable with 5 or 6. He's saying 7 or 8.
And there's another part where that makes sense, given that this team is now in transition, right? If this season had gone differently, if the Canucks were second in the Pacific, if you were talking about this team looking at Besser and deciding whether or not to protect their current competitive window, that might be a different conversation, because then the surplus value of what he can provide, or the value of what he can provide in the first several years of the contract, become more heavily weighted, right? More important to you, and the risk becomes more tolerable on a long-term deal. Well, if you're not a contending team, that equation flips. Right. So that's sort of part of how the larger whole impacts this specifically. So Besser, not quite on the block, but not quite untouchable at the moment. Not quite off the block either, as the club determines exactly, what course to chart forward.
And I do think, as you said, no real sense of urgency. Right. And people might hear that and think like, what the heck? We're two weeks today from the trade deadline. Shouldn't this all be very urgent? As you said, the reason there haven't been negotiations ongoing is because both sides have a pretty crystal clear picture of what the demands are and what each other's positions are. So from that perspective, it's almost become a matter of, well, who's going to blink? And do the Canucks say, you know what, we're willing to get uncomfortable, we're willing to go there, pick up the phone, boom, let's make a deal. Or does the other side say, well, hey, you know what,
we want to stay.
6 years, do this, and we'll stay, right? And so in that, like, that to me removes a sense of urgency, because you know it can come together pretty quickly. And I would say the other part of it is, again, like Brock Besser, it's not a complicated deadline deal. It's not a remotely complicated deadline
deal.
He's
good.
You know what I mean? Like, he's not making a prohibitive amount. You can retain if you need to. You can ramp up trade talks and find a taker and probably get value pretty quickly. It's not as if you need to make this monumental decision now and start canvassing the market and, oh, who's really going to be interested? It's like, no, he's a goal-scoring pending UFA winger on a reasonable deal. Like, those guys get moved all the time at the deadline. It's easy. You know roughly what to expect in return. So both ways, the decision, it's not like it requires a ton of lead time to execute whatever decision you can make. You can go to March 6th and be like, okay, here's what we're doing, and get it done.
Right. And honestly, with the way that the team performed post-Miller trade, it actually does make more sense, in my view, to look. You don't get enough time to actually let the sample pool enough to make a confident decision either way. But don't you want to see how this team plays coming out of the break, given the way they control play?
I desperately want to see them with Quinn Hughes in the lineup.
Right.
We haven't seen that yet.
Right. So, Quinn Hughes. Well, let me do Pettersson first.
Okay.
So, Pettersson, obviously another sort of disappointing tournament. Doesn't appear to have had the flu.
Yeah, that was another tidbit from Elliot Friedman today, which is just like, that was puts the whole thing into even
more interesting context. Yeah. He was benched. And so a pretty miserable Four Nations performance for Pettersson on, to sort of punctuate what's been a pretty difficult season for him on the ice. And, you know, look, the truth of the matter is that Pettersson remains off the block. The club wants to make this work. But look, there's obviously a significant risk factor here, and the club is frustrated by the way that he's performed, just like fans are, just like even fans that are the most supportive of him are. You know, there is an internal sense that Pettersson's lack of preparation over the course of the summer, the fact that he didn't have a good enough summer, has spiraled on him, right? That you know, and this matches pretty closely with the club's public commentary about how he didn't maybe grasp how difficult it was going to be, right? There's a sense that he began this season behind the eight ball, and that, you know, he might need some patience, frankly, to find that level and put in the work required to succeed at the highest level of this sport. Now, what does that mean? Well, I don't think he's on the block now, but I do think if a team called with a grand idea, that the club would at least listen.
Yeah. If Columbus called with Kent Johnson and whatever,
right,
there'd be meetings.
Right. But Vancouver's not shopping him enough that Cole Sillinger starts a conversation.
Yeah.
Right. Like that's,
you're
I think
in that
that's
gap.
Right. I think that's right. They're in that gap. And, you know, obviously there's the sort of false pressure point about the no trade or the no move kicks in on July 1. I think it would be going too far to say that the club doesn't view that as a like deadline of sorts. There's obviously a decision that has to be made in going into the next league year, but I don't think it's one that's prohibitive, right? Like the truth is that these aren't bulletproof,
it's more,
ironclad things.
It's more of a soft deadline maybe than like a, oh no, it's over now. Like we have to make a final decision on this player.
It's a moment to make another decision, but you look, how does this transition work if Pettersson doesn't get back to who he's been for most of his career?
Yeah.
You know, pretty difficult. So,
So I guess the big question then is, what's the internal, and I'm not expecting you necessarily to have an answer to this, but what's the internal appetite? If so much of it comes down to preparation, I guess two questions then. What are they going to do to help him have a different summer, right? How do you support the player to make the changes that you think he needs to make? And how much confidence do they have that if that happens, we're really excited about the player we think we're going to get?
Well,
those are the big questions that pop to mind for me.
So I don't have a good feel for the first part of it. I think more than anything, it's like, look, you've got to understand how hard you have to work.
Yes.
I think that's...
Well, it's the classic, like, you can lead a horse to water, but you can't make him drink, right? Yeah.
But on the second one, I think there's a lot of confidence in Pettersson as a player, just not at the moment, right? And honestly, I think there's even a feeling that if you come into next season and he has the type of summer he needs to, it still might take him some time to hit that level. So I actually think there's a fair bit of patience still for him, even though... Obviously, this has tested it pretty significantly, and the fact that in the organization's view, it's as a result of a lack of work rate. I mean, that's obviously difficult to swallow given the extension that they signed him to 12 months ago.
Yeah, and it's just so fascinating because the conversation around Elias Pettersson has become like so weirdly polarized, and there's almost like a moral element to it in a lot of people's view now, where it's like, either you think it's tendonitis and that like excuses him for his poor performance, or you think it's all his fault and you don't want to hear about the tendonitis. The role of the tendonitis to me, that like theory or what role it is playing in his poor performance, has always been fascinating because in some ways, as much as it's become positioned as the like, oh, I'm a big pro PD guy and it's all just the tendonitis. It's like, well, you're telling I'm open to it being a tendonitis related thing, but you're telling me that for the last year, the tendonitis has completely sapped his effectiveness as a player, didn't get better over the summer, won't get better by sitting him down for a few weeks, which is why he hasn't missed games with it. It's like, that's pretty concerning about a player's long-term future, if you ask me. So even that, it's not like, oh, yeah, don't worry about it. He just has tendonitis. It's like, but that's very concerning then if it's having this big an impact on him.
Yeah, and look, there's all... I mean, I'm going to editorialize here. So to sort of separate this from my emptying my fact-based notebook, or my reporter notebook, you know, I like to distinguish between return to play and return to performance, right? So Pettersson's not injured because he's playing, right?
Yep.
But that doesn't mean that he's ready to perform.
That he's 100%.
To his top level, or that the tendonitis held him back from having the summer he needed. And as a result, right, it has sort of snowballed on him over the course of the season.
I think if I had to like lay down my, and it would not with a ton of confidence, but my like official Pettersson hypothesis, it's tendonitis combined with a lack of confidence from the playoffs last year and the lead into the playoffs. That combination screwed up his summer, and then it spiraled as a result of that, right?
Yeah.
So like tendonitis plus mental stuff, didn't have a good summer, it spiraled. Now there's a combination of physical and mental stuff going on.
Yes.
That's kind of my best attempt at connecting the dots.
Yeah, and by the way, Elliot Friedman, of course, it was rough for him at the Four Nations, said Friedman on the 32 Thoughts pod. I know he's battling something. I don't know. There's a lot of pushback on that. I don't even know what to say about it, so I'm just going to stop there. He was asked by Jason Brough on the morning show today for clarification, and he said, there's people who say he's hurt, and there's people who say they don't think it's something that should be preventing him from playing. I don't know. So, obviously, there's some... sort of murky. There's a murky. It's been such a murky situation.
It's so weird.
And you know, that complicates everything. My understanding, though, like what I can say confidently is not on the block, right? If someone blows the Canucks socks off, I do think there's a sense that, hey, we'd be stupid not to listen given the size of this risk. The NMC deadline is not a firm one, but it's something, right? It's sort of a semi-permeable membrane, let's call it that. Like something where they'll certainly have another conversation at some point this summer, and fundamentally the organization thinks it's on him to have the sort of summer he needs to get to where he wants to go as a player. Quinn Hughes.
Sorry, last thing here. You guys just learning about tendonitis. It hurts and flares up on occasion, not all the time, but can affect the little things in your day-to-day. But it's been constant. That's my thing. If it's the kind, like, if it was the kind of thing where it's like, hey, he has a really good 3 weeks. Oh, and then a not so great 2 weeks because the tendonitis flared up. Well, you know what I mean? But it's been constant.
Well, also, you're like splitting the baby between the Bruff Yips thesis and my physical diminishment thesis. Like, that's basically where you're trying to drive down the middle.
I think they're interlinked.
So
they're connected.
So this listener is trying to tell me that.
No, he's trying to tell me, oh, no, of course it's all tendonitis.
Well, I've been trying to tell you for months, and you won't listen to me, so good luck,
Texter. But my point is, if you're like, oh, it comes and goes, and it flares up, well, it's like, well, that's not consistent with what we're seeing. Like, yeah. That would be more consistent with, like, oh, we're getting 90% Pettersson a lot. Sometimes we get 100%, sometimes it's 85%, but, like, instead what we're getting is 50% Pettersson for 12 months.
Fair enough. That's
the difference. Anyways, go ahead.
Hughes. So, look, obviously he wanted to go. You know, I think there's a sense internally that maybe too much has been made of the, did the Canucks stand in the way? Did he want to go? Sort of narrative that's been out there since really Chris Johnston and Mike Russo, my colleagues at The Athletic, ran a piece on what exactly happened with the Hughes reinforcement.
Mm-hmm.
Look, my understanding is he's still not been cleared. So we'll see what practice looks like today. It will be his second full practice, right? Not in a full contact jersey. Club standard protocol requires you to practice twice to be cleared anyway. And we'll sort of see exactly what his availability for Saturday looks like. I don't have a sense of that exactly, but it's certainly something I'll be watching at Morning Skate and asking about at Morning Skate on Saturday. So I'm not taking it, and this is, again, me editorializing, I'm not taking it to the bank that Hughes is just going to be back necessarily on Saturday, which I think is important context that should loom over this, right? This entire discussion. One interesting thing that I sort of heard while asking around that I think also gives some context here, you know, both Patrick Alvin, Rick Tocchet, and Jim Rutherford share one common experience throughout their professional careers as coaches, managers, etc. Do you know what it is?
Sidney Crosby.
Close relationship with Sidney Crosby. And one thing I'd never been told before, but that I was when I was working the phones over the last 48 hours, was like, when you work with Sidney Crosby, you start to have this sense that it's like, wow, like this person, this leader, this competitor, right, is someone unlike anyone I'll ever have a chance to work with again. And increasingly among the Canucks brain trust, there's actually a sense that actually we might have found another guy, another
wow.
person, player, leader of that caliber. And so just keep that in mind, because as we discuss like the Canucks handling of this or their role in the relationship, like I promise you, given the way that he's talked about internally at that sort of level, that they're not risking that relationship.
Well, and if you've been paying attention at all since all of Rutherford, Tocchet, Alvin arrived in Vancouver, you know what even suggesting that he's in that conversation as a leader and a competitor with Sidney Crosby, that's literally the highest praise they could give somebody as a hockey player.
Oh, 100%.
Like literally, there is nothing better
and,
they could say about him.
And it goes beyond praising him as a hockey player.
Yes.
Okay. Last one. Carson Soucy.
Hold on. Just the last thing on Quinn Hughes, and this might be just be like more of a your sense than reporting thing, but is this like a, we could be, how much of it is going to be like a lingering thing for the rest of the season? Do you have a sense of that?
On his injury?
Yeah.
Well, only the sense that he gave us with his answer,
right,
which is yes, it's going to be a lingering thing.
Okay.
That's truly not me reporting anything. That's me reading between the lines of his answer on Tuesday when asked, basically, is this going to clear up? And
yep.
He was like, I'm just focused on the net. You know, like you could just tell.
Yeah.
Quinn Hughes is pretty matter of fact, typically speaking. Right?
All right. Carson Soucy.
Carson Soucy. So look, Soucy obviously was put out in an email blast. His name, he was made available in an email blast to other NHL general managers. Of course, he has full no trade protection and a young family. You know, it was a surprise to me because typically speaking, this organization's been really high on his defensive game. They still are. Like, they still are. You know, I think there is a sense internally that the way that he's performed since demonstrates that, you know, a little bit of a kick in the butt maybe helped get his game back to being in the right place. I think the fact that the Pettersson acquisition has helped him move down the lineup a little bit. I think that matters. I think his flexibility to play either side, I think his quality as a person means that the club is still very much open to making this work this season and next through which he's signed for. So I'm not saying that Soucy's off the block or anything like that. I still think it's telling that the club dangled him so widely to the NHL's other member clubs, but you know, I'm not on high alert expecting a Soucy trade necessarily, and I don't think the club views like reallocating that cap space elsewhere as being like an urgent priority so much as something that, you know, certainly they have been willing to
something they wouldn't close the door on.
Yeah.
And it's interesting. Actually, you mentioned, you know, his versatility moving over to the right side. We kind of glossed over this because we're so hyped for the Four Nations. But at the practices this week, or at least the one where Quinn Hughes was a full participant, the third pairing was Elias Pettersson, DPD on the left side, Carson Soucy on the right side, and Forbert as an extra. Now, we'll see how that plays out tomorrow, how this plays out on the road trip in the near future. Like, Forbort could still jump back in. It could take a number of different permutations. But I thought that was really interesting, that it was kind of Forbort, at least for that practice, on the outside looking in, and does bode well for, yeah, sure, third pairing guy. But, okay, Carson Soucy in your third pairing, that's a pretty nice a nice thing to have in your lineup. So, interesting reporting there. Good job by you, Drance. Well done emptying the notebook.
Buddy.
Getting that intel out for our listeners. We'll take a break. Dmitry Filipovich, he's going to join us for the final segment here. We will talk all things Four Nations. Maybe look ahead to next year's Olympics in 2026 in Italy. Who improved their stock? Who hurt their stock? All that good stuff coming up next with Dmitry Filipovich here on Canucks Talk Sportsnet 650. Welcome back to Canucks Talk here on Sportsnet 650. I'm Jamie Dodd. Thomas Drance is here as well. We're live from the Kintech studio. 650, 650 is the Dunbar Lumber text line. Metro Vancouver's trusted choice for contractors and rental warriors for over 50 years. Visit them at one of their three locations to serve you or online at DunbarLumber.com. And our buddy Dim, of course, hosts the Hockey PDO cast.
He's coming to shake the earth.
Yeah, he's going to join us here. And we've learned one very important thing, that if there's an earthquake in Metro Vancouver, as apparently there just was, the studio at Sportsnet 650 is a good spot to be. You two were here. I was not. I felt it. I was down the hall in the bathroom. I felt it.
Yeah. And so did
I
our
came back
station.
And I was like, did we just have an earthquake?
Yeah.
You guys were like, no.
Well, we didn't feel anything at all in this studio. So I think this is the bunker now. This is like where we should be.
Yep.
And of course, for those who are wondering if they've lost their minds, you have not.
Nope, there was an earthquake.
The U.S. Geological Survey has confirmed a 4.8 magnitude earthquake being recorded with its epicenter 27 kilometers north by northeast of Sechelt, British Columbia.
Wow. Look at Thomas.
That is real-time reporting.
Thomas Peter Mansbridge Drance over here. It's like an official radio station.
Well, I wasn't going to say like, yeah, it's confirmed. Like, I don't know. People are wondering.
Yeah. And
my dog, apparently, my wife texted, my dog was very spooked.
Our producer, Lena, is working from home in North Van, which was like closer to the epicenter. And she said, I think it was the biggest earthquake she's ever felt. So we didn't feel much here, but some people around the province and in the lower mainland definitely did feel it. So I don't know. It sounds like everyone's okay. I haven't seen any reports of damage or anything. Hopefully that's the case. But always interesting when we get an earthquake.
4.7 is pretty reasonable.
Well, especially that close, because often we'll get them where the epicenter's like, you know, miles off the coast or whatever, right? And this one, it's like, oh, that's pretty close.
30 kilometers off the coast of Haida Gwaii or something.
Yeah. All right.
That's disquieting.
I mean, whatever. We're Vancouverites, right? That's part of the deal. We live here. We've all experienced it before. All right, Tim, let's get into it. Gold medal game. Or gold medal, whatever. I don't know. They got gold medals, but it was the final, the championship game.
They didn't get silver medals. That's what I was disappointed
by. Poor Team USA.
They should have made them stand there and sadly receive silver medals the way nature intended the Team USA to do.
They should have skipped silver and just gone right to bronze. It's like, you guys get the bronze medals. No silver in this one.
Because the bronze medal is something you win. That's for Finnish people.
That's true.
Silver medals are things you lose. That's for Americans.
Okay, so like in the Olympics for the basketball, when Team Serbia won the bronze medal game, but they had 6 hours to drink, and then Jokic showed up drunk. How amazing would it have been to see like Barkov just coming out wasted to receive third place in Four Nations?
Oh, man. I love that you just assumed that the Finns would win
100%
the bronze medal
game. Of course.
They would have treated it like a gold medal game.
I know. That's why Finland is so cool.
They were rounding into form as the tournament ended.
Well, and so I honestly think one thing that we need to keep in mind for Milan, okay, is the quality of competition now. Based on how good the United States are, based on how good Finland is, based on how good Sweden is, you know, based on how good Russia is, if they're permitted to play, Czechia, the reigning world champions, you know, Switzerland playing.
I'd say Germany.
I mean,
Stutzla, Sider.
Look,
Paterka. That's a good team.
We shouldn't take it for granted that Canada is the magic team. And I think it's important that when Team Canada goes to Milan, that the expectation is gold, because look, this is the magic team, but that we all understand that provided they medal, that's an accomplishment.
I'm not sure I'm prepared to say a bronze medal is an accomplishment for Canada.
I don't think it would be received that way.
See, no. I think showing up in a bronze medal game and actually trying and caring about it and having enough pride to win is a massive accomplishment.
Finland understood the assignment.
Yes.
Because that game against Canada when they went six forwards with the empty net and scored two goals and put a scare in them
was
probably
terrifying.
The coolest moment of the tournament, just in terms of like them pulling that off with what they had to work with. And so I love the way they approached it. Obviously didn't have the same talent as some of these other teams, but they came to play.
Yeah, they absolutely did. So, okay, interesting that you're going right to, you know, 2026 and lessons, and we can't just assume the dominance and all of that. And you know, Canada won, so we don't do the national symposium on Canada hockey, right? We're just celebrating, and that's great. I mean, I was celebrating as much as anyone yesterday, but there's always lessons you can learn from a tournament like this as we get into now a regular best-on-best calendar in the NHL in the world of hockey. What, and this could be like good lessons, bad, like, you know, things they should change, things they should keep the same. What lessons do you think Hockey Canada should take from this tournament, Tim?
I think the blue line is the clear starting point, especially when you saw what Team USA was able to field on that end of the ice. And just they had six guys, I guess five, because Adam Fox was really struggling with the pace of it, but he's still obviously a highly skilled defender. Just guys who could move, how much trouble they gave Canada in terms of breaking their forecheck and getting the puck out of their own zone cleanly. And then you watch that game progress, and it came pretty clear that John Cooper couldn't really get away with playing Colton Parayko and Travis Sanheim together, because every one of their shifts felt like something disastrous was going to happen. Now, I know that Alex Pietrangelo withdrew, Shea Theodore got hurt, Josh Morrissey was ill, obviously, Thomas Harley stepped in immensely in his place, but I feel like that would be the starting point in terms of not taking it for granted that, all right, we're just going to bring like six defensemen who all have to play a certain role. I think you can approach it through the lens of, we should just bring flat out the six best defensemen who give us the best chance to win.
Yeah, and I think Thomas Harley is so interesting. I mean, first of all, you got to think he booked his spot on the Olympic team with that performance.
Yep.
Going from not in the picture to top four guy in the final game is incredible. But, you know, it's not like, Thomas Harley's 6'3". Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? It's not like you're sacrificing all this world of size and toughness by bringing him. You're just making sure that you have a guy who can move the puck and who can make plays with the puck on his stick. And, you know, there's only so many of those dudes, so you might not be able to have like 6'3" guys who match that description. But with this kind of reintroduction of best on best hockey, it was a reminder that the pace is just so high. There's such a high baseline you need to clear. And the first question is, do you clear that baseline of speed and skill and decision making? Then you can start worrying about, okay, what's your size? What's your toughness? All of that.
And especially if we're talking just the upcoming Olympics, I think the big discrepancy between that and what we saw in the Four Nations is going to be the way the games are officiated.
Because
these games were very resembling NHL playoffs.
Well, like all the guys that you're like, he's our designated penalty killer. Yes. Well, that was a waste.
Like, that guy's not going to play. It really felt like, I know that, you know, there was the one penalty on Trocheck where he tripped at it. But for the most part, it felt like it was either going to need to be like someone shooting the puck out of play or some sort of obvious high stake that drew blood and they just couldn't not call it.
Even most of the tournament, there weren't that many penalties.
No, it was like,
how many of them were high sticks also? Like a lot of them where it's like, oh, well, that's just, we have to call that.
Yeah, it was like, it was I would say under 2.5 per game, right? And so I don't think that's going to be the way the game's officiated in under IIHF rules and in the Olympics. And so in that case, you don't want to overcompensate by being like, all right, well, we need to match America's physicality and their toughness. And
no.
So we're going to bring Tom Wilson and all these other guys.
That's what I don't get. It's like, if you think Tom Wilson should have been on this team, that's totally fine. But it's not going to be like that in the Olympics. Yeah. And if the Tkachuks are like running around at 100 miles an hour trying to take guys out of the board into the boards at the Olympics, that's a very different proposition on the big ice sheet than it is at these games.
I also think people are not prepared for how dominant fast defenders are. Is the international ice sheet being used?
We need to figure that out. I would assume so, but probably not a good thing for me to do.
I was under the impression that they were going to be playing on NHL surface moving forward.
Good. I mean, hopefully not. But if the rink is... I'm trying to figure it out. But the truth is that...
You say your point, I'll figure it out.
If the sheet is international ice sized, the level of dominance that Quinn Hughes and Sanderson and
according to Chris Johnston, it will be on NHL sized ice.
Thank God.
So there you go.
I think it will be moving forward for all these best.
All right,
that's good. It has to be because it's too slow. Okay, so never mind. I'm going to change my.
But still, I mean, compare it to the pace we saw in this tournament. Well, I think it still applies.
I think the fact is that Canada needs to be even more disciplined about bringing puck moving D, and in fact, when you look through the rosters that of Team Canada's that have fallen short in the past, like the 2006, the last time they went to Italy, right? The Canadian defense. Rob Blake, Robin Regier, Chris Pronger, Adam Foote, great players. But Wade Redden and Jay Bomeister, and I guess Brian McCabe were kind of the puck movers, and McCabe wasn't a burner in terms of speed, and frankly, neither was Wade Redden, right? It was really Bomeister's the only guy that plays like... And that was on international ice. Like, shocker, they didn't win. You know what I mean? Like, Thomas Harley needs to be a fixture. More emphasis on speed. You absolutely do not want to find yourself in a game like last night's with a Sanheim-Pareko pair where both players, I think, played well. It's just they didn't work together with the speed of America's on rushing forwards on retrievals.
I think also what became clear in that final game yesterday was the discrepancy between the two teams' fourth lines. And sometimes that can kind of obviously get overlooked or sometimes we can even put too much stock in it. It doesn't really matter. But in that game, as it progressed, especially as it went into overtime, Canada, the contributions they got from Bennett and Jarvis and Marchand versus Team USA, obviously Tkachuk getting banged up in the second period, re-aggravating his injury and not being able to continue, handcuffed them a little bit. But Kreider, who they put in instead of Connor, couldn't play. Brock Nelson was incredibly struggling. Vincent Trocheck as well. And so they wound up having to use like JT Miller with Jack Hughes and essentially just shortened their bench to three lines. And it felt like that made such a massive difference, whereas Canada was actually able to use their guys. So I think the lesson in that is not approaching it through the perspective of we need to bring in 12 guys and everyone has this specific role. Because as we saw in this tournament, the best players in the world in this type of setting take on those roles naturally, right? Like you can see like Jack Eichel in that final was playing a defensive role where he was pounding Cale Makar at the blue line. Austin Matthews was playing sort of a checking defensive role in this tournament more so than just being a pure goal scorer. Same for Canada's guys. And so I think just bringing the 18 best skaters and assuming that they're good enough to fit whatever role they need to within the context of the team is the way to go about it, as opposed to bringing guys who are going to kill penalties or guys who are going to be stay at home.
Well, and I think they compounded it by scratching Kyle Connor, yes, which yes, is a weird one. But then also you think, like, how much would they have loved in the third period and overtime to have had Tage Thompson or Clayton Keller or go down the list, right, to be able to use on their bench, and they just didn't have it.
So I want to call this early. Okay. I want to do a winner's draft and then a loser's draft coming out of the Four Nations. You can draft a sports entity, you can draft a country, you can draft the U.S. press secretary, you can draft the NHLPA, you can draft a team, you can draft an individual player. But let's do a winner's draft, okay, and then let's do a loser's draft.
But I don't want to get started just yet.
No, but if we're going to do both, I wanted to talk winners and losers. Okay, so like this, we're going to build
last,
a segment around
the last draft. Thing I want to throw to Dim is from Team Canada, one player not involved in this that you want to see in 2026.
Okay, fair.
Oh, I think the answer for me has to be Dylan Gunther.
Yeah, I love it. My guy.
I feel like they really needed that guy, especially with Sam Reinhart at times kind of struggled with fitting with either McKinnon or McDavid. Mark Stone, especially in that final, got played off the ice a little bit in terms of the pace he was able to keep up at. They were really missing that sort of Matt Boldy type of winger, a guy with some range and some size, but has the skill to come off the wall, can play with your other top playmakers. And that's Gunther, especially as you think he's going to be like turning 23, I think, by the time the Olympics roll around. How good he is already as a goal scorer, but how many different facets he has to his game. I feel like he's sort of the perfect prototype of player that this current version of Team Canada could use. So I think for him, it's a bit sort of off the beaten path. I think people would assume it would be either Tom Wilson or one of the defenders that didn't make it, like a Uyghur or a Montour. But in my opinion, I really do think Dylan Gunther is the perfect player for what this Team Canada needs.
I like it.
I love it.
All right.
Let's draft. Let's start with winners.
Okay. Canada.
you go first. Okay.
That's too much of a cop out.
No. I think it's
good. But like, honestly, I just
get into it.
That was the most fun I've had watching sports in an awful long time last night. Heck, and yeah. I bet there's a lot of people around the country who are saying the same thing. Maybe the most I've ever cheered a goal, like even including the golden goal. It was fantastic. Saying, "Oh, Canada," with the whole bar. Everyone was riled up, high fiving people on the way home. It was fantastic. It felt so good. We needed it, as John Cooper said last night. So, like, yeah, man, it's a cop out, but the country, the team, Canada, the country, number one winner, because that ruled last night.
Fair. You want the snake spot or you want to go second?
I'll go snake because there's so many picks. Play the odds.
I'm going to go winner. I'm going to go with the Ottawa Senators.
Nice.
Okay. So the Ottawa Senators are a fringe playoff team in the Eastern Conference, but they're 5-on-5 game. Like, honestly, they're LA Kings East. Okay. And their defensive game is trending exceptionally well. They've been wildly unfortunate in terms of how they finish, although they don't generate that much. So it's not just bad luck. They need to get more offensive juice going in terms of, I think, how they play and how they look to create offense. But their defensive game is high end at this point. Like, we're talking about one of the five best defensive teams, one of the 10 best 5-on-5 teams in the league, the sort of profile of a team that if they get a little bit of luck in net, with Linus Ullmark getting healthy and finding his form, they could actually make noise. And now you've got Brady Tkachuk and Jake Sanderson, two guys who are tailor-made to be absolute pains in the butt for an opponent in a playoff series, who have now been blooded on a huge stage. They now have big game confidence and big game experience. I know Brady Tkachuk picked up a knock or two at the tournament. I mean, how could he not with the way that he played? But still, going back to Ottawa, I guarantee you those two gentlemen are going to have a level of confidence to permit them to elevate their game. That's exactly what an Ottawa team that hasn't made the playoffs in forever and that is in a tooth and nail race with five or six other teams in the NHL's more loaded with mid-teams conference. I think that's experience that will stand the Ottawa Senators well between now and game 82. And honestly, into the playoffs.
Yep. I like that. My first winner, I'll go Sam Bennett, who started this tournament as the 13th forward,
yes,
played 8 minutes or so, and was effective, but only 8 minutes in the first meeting between these two teams, was immense in the final, scored the goal to tie it up at 2-2, school JT Miller, along the wall, and then a beautiful finish in tight. You should have seen Thomas. Thomas and I were watching the final here in the studio before we recorded our post-game show. He was doing the Michael Corleone, just when I thought I was out, he pulled me back in.
Well, we're talking about like the baseline to hang in this tournament. If you had to pick like one Team Canada forward who you're like, ooh, I don't know if he has it before, you'd be Sam Bennett.
Yep.
And then in that game, you're like, yeah, Sam Bennett's on the ice. No. Let's go.
After the first game, the first Canada-US game when he came into the lineup, after that game, I started saying weird stuff about Sam Bennett. Like, I'd go to war with that guy. Like, just like the way that he played, he immediately endeared himself to me. I watch a lot of Panthers. I've admired his game. I covered his 18-year-old series very closely back in the day. But like, I thought he hit a totally different level in this tournament, and I'm so in.
I love that as a litmus test for how much you like a player. Like, how much weird stuff am I saying about this guy? It's off the charts right now.
And if they wearing a Team Canada jersey on the crest, it's like, you know, I'll start.
I'm getting weird, baby.
I'll be like, put that guy on our money. It's like, what? Chill, man. Anyway,
all right, second pick for you, Dib.
I love that. There's so many good choices to go. I'm going to stay on brand here, though, and similar to what I just said about Sam Bennett, I'll go with Thomas Harley.
Yeah.
For what you said in terms of the opportunity he got and the circumstances with not knowing whether he was going to play, obviously day of, Josh Morrissey's sick, he steps in, the role he played, John Cooper used him as his third most heavily used defenseman. He looked awesome. He's going to go back to Dallas now as their number one defenseman with Miro Heiskanen out and play 25 minutes a night heading into the playoffs. And then you look at what happened with the other defenders around him, right? Whether it's Pietrangelo sort of withdrawing and his age and the questions around that, Doughty and the way he looked, and obviously his age as well. I feel like his spot on that 2026 version of this team, you can write that down right now. Like, it's almost a lock in my opinion.
Yes.
So just how far he came in that regard over the past 10 days or so, I feel like that has to make him a clear.
I just think purely no one has done more for their like recognition and respect for hockey fans than Thomas Harley.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's like, oh my gosh, we love this guy now.
It's my pick.
What? Oh yeah, you're right.
I am going to draft hockey. The game of hockey was a big winner, dominated ESPN coverage in the United States all day yesterday for much of this week, basically had the stage to itself, and the game delivered an overtime thriller. The amount of like fantasy football analysts or like Americans that I follow for my other interests.
JJ Watt.
Yes. Well, no, but Christian JJ Watt,
he's always been a hockey guy. Yeah.
But Christian McCaffrey, right? Like,
wants the best of three series.
As he should. The amount of unaffiliated sports fans or just like normies who are American based, who were just completely riveted and transfixed by that game and had takes on it and were making jokes, you know, listening to the Bill Simmons podcast and that Van Lathan guy saying that he'd never understood that you could kill a power play, right? Like, just the amount of small open-mindedness, right? Just like opening the crack a little bit to a variety of people who are sports fans and should be naturally inclined to like the game more, who now will have their attention back on it. You hope that the Stanley Cup final, that the stretch run of the season can keep that momentum going just a little bit. But I think the NHL legitimately kicked down the door, at least a crack in the American consciousness. And I think that matters a ton for this game and for our business.
Okay, I'll wrap up here with my last winner pick. We'll do losers quickly. Now, I was going to go away from Team Canada for this one, but I mean, who am I kidding? I'm a homer, so I'm going to stick with Drew Doughty. Looked like he wasn't going to be in this tournament. Pietrangelo pulls out. He had just gotten back on the ice and didn't love what I saw from him in the first couple of games, but man, he was awesome last night and kind of really, we'll see if he's a factor for the Olympics. I never want to count Drew Doughty out of a Team Canada situation, because I do feel like that win kind of puts his stamp, a capstone, as an all-time Team Canada performer. Two Olympic golds, World Cup gold, now the Four Nations, World Junior champion. Like, he is one of the all-time best when it comes to representing Canada, and he showed it again last night. Great performance. All right, who wants to start losers from the Four Nations?
I'll go.
Okay.
New York.
Team USA.
Okay. No, I'm going to New York.
Yes, that's a good...
Unequivocally.
The city or just the team? Are you lumping in Brock Nelson?
No, I am. Everyone involved.
I love it.
Anyone with any affiliation.
Jack Hughes?
Although I think Jack Hughes unfairly getting a lot of blame, like in terms of who he was playing with, and I thought he was still good in this tournament. Obviously didn't score the way I think people expected, but Brock Nelson, Vincent Trocheck, Chris Kreider, Adam Fox, JT Miller in the role he was asked to play, I think overextended. Those are the worst players on the ice for Team USA yesterday, and probably the difference in the outcome of that game and then winning and losing this tournament. And so I feel like just lumping them all together makes them the clear loser.
Okay, I'll go two. I'll give Drance the snake slot, and I don't have to say a lot about this one, but I'll take Elias Pettersson because that was a tough look and a really, really tough ending for his tournament.
I think that's a very, very strong pick.
Thank you.
I'm going to go with Bill Guerin. I think Team USA ended up with only 8 usable forwards that could maintain the pace in that game, and given that Tage Thompson, Matthew Nyes, Jason Robertson, I mean, I can keep going, right? Logan Cooley, Clayton Keller. Like, I can go 6 or 7.
Cole Caulfield.
Right. I can keep going. But even like, Cole Caulfield is like, too small.
Yeah.
Like, you know, I can go, like, long with guys who don't meet that description. I mean, how different does that game potentially look if America's fourth line is Robertson, Tage Thompson, and Matthew Nyes? 3 guys who weren't even on the roster.
Mm-hmm.
So, I think ultimately, like, Mike Sullivan had a good plan. I don't know that he had the horses up front last night. In addition to the other, like, courting Trump stuff and some of the political tone deafness of that, although it certainly amped up the stakes, I think Bill Guerin deserves to be on this list.
You're a snake. You're the snake here.
You're a snake.
A snake.
I'm a snake. I'm going to go with... I'm going to go with Team USA's golden era. I don't think they have a long runway in which they'll be at parity with Canada, but they are at the moment, and they missed one of a fleeting number of golden opportunities to actually beat the Magic team. Unfortunately, they're not the Magic team. They're the Washington Generals of best on best.
They're the foil.
Yeah, they're the LA Clippers.
Yeah.
Counterpoint, back-to-back World Junior Championship victories.
For sure, but we're in a run of 7 of 8 first overalls that are Canadian.
Yeah.
Like, way to go. You win because our elite talent's already in the NHL.
That's fair.
I don't know what to tell you.
All right. It's me?
Yeah.
Okay. We got to go rapid fire here. So I will go. Oh, man. I just have one in my head. Oh, boy.
Do you want me to go while you wait?
Oh, boy. Yeah. I'll trade this pick for
I'm gonna
you.
I'm going to go with people who are skeptical heading into this tournament.
That's a great
competitive
answer. That's a great answer.
There was a lot of, no one's going to try. It's going to be exhibition. It's going to be like the All-Star game. And nope, right from puck drop of Canada-Sweden, it was max intensity, the most competitive, highest-paced hockey we've seen all year, really. So,
yep.
One of our best show takes
Absolutely.
Of the season,
Absolutely.
By the way. We were like
strong.
Team, we were Team Four Nations
from the beginning of
rock.
The year. Yeah. Okay, I'll go with both critics of Jordan Binnington, but also the rest of Canada's goalies, because now you have to unseat him from the picture. So critics of Jordan Binnington, we didn't get to pick him as a winner, which is an oversight on our part, but his critics are losers now for sure. All right, that's it for today. Canucks are back in action twice over the weekend, so have a great weekend. Thanks for listening. Thanks for texting. We're back on Monday for Canucks Talk on Sportsnet 650.